Good evening. Welcome to the reading this evening by Laura Kosciuski. One note before we get started. There is a reading later this month at the Archives Bookshop. The writer Sue Williams Silverman will be reading from her memoir, Because I Remember Terror, Father, I Remember You, which is a beautiful and terrifying memoir of her experience of being an incest survivor. And at the risk of sounding self-serving, I will be reading with Sue on the 24th at the Archives. So it's a moment, I guess, to introduce myself. My name is Mark Sheehan, and I'll be introducing Laura Kosciuski this evening. We get right down to it. Laura Kosciuski is one terrific writer. It's hard enough to be either a fine poet or a fine fiction writer, but to be one of the country's best young poets as well as one of its best young novelists is one hell of an achievement. Laura Kosciuski is the author of three books of poetry, Wild Brides, Housekeeping in a Dream, and Fire and Flower. She has a fourth collection due out from Carnegie Mellon University Press. She is also the author of two novels, Suspicious River and the newly published White Bird in a Blizzard. If I had to choose a single word to describe the entire range of Laura's work, I would probably single out the intensity in both her fiction and her poetry. As I was writing this introduction, I was thinking about the lines from her darkly funny poem, Babysitter, where she writes, "At 16, I discovered sex in the back seat of a cannibal's car, though we only went so far. It was my first taste of human flesh, and it was tender and sweet." That same intensity, even darker and more dangerous, is there in the story of Lila Murray, the main character of her novel, Suspicious River, who accepts money for sex in a search for something or someone to break through the numbing repetition of her days, which has made her a kind of spiritual zombie. I first became aware of Laura's work when she was still an undergraduate, I was helping to be a judge for a poetry competition in Grand Rapids. All of the local judges agreed that Laura's poetry was by far and away the best. A nationally known poet who was the final judge, who will remain anonymous, dropped a lot of notches in my estimation when she did not choose Laura's work to be the winner of whatever poetry award we were giving away. A few years later, Laura and I were fellow students, and I probably shouldn't admit this, at MSU. We were together at the University of Michigan doing MFA degrees together. I was proud during that time to win a Hopwood Award, but Laura won 12 of them. She has also been awarded a National Endowment for the Arts grant, the Alice Faye DeCasnola Award from the Poetry Society of America, and the Bobst Award for Emerging Writers. She teaches creative writing at Washtenaw Community College and lives in Chelsea, Michigan. Please give a very warm welcome this evening to Laura Kosciuski.
Turn my mic on. Do I sound all right? Am I getting double mic'd? And does that sound okay? I hear a little feedback, but. Thank you very much for that wonderful introduction. Mark has introduced me before, and I feel now, as I did then, that if we could just end at the introduction, you would walk out feeling very impressed by me. Well, now I'll try to read as well. I thought I would like to read some poems tonight, as well as reading some sections from my new novel, which is White Bird in a Blizzard. The novel concerns a teenage girl who, through the course of the novel, becomes a young woman. It follows her through four different Januaries. Her mother has disappeared during one of the Januaries, and I thought I would just read a little bit from all four of the Januaries. The first January is 1986. I am 16 when my mother steps out of her skin one frozen January afternoon. pure self, atoms twinkling like microscopic diamond chips around her, perhaps the chiming of a clock or a few bright flute notes in the distance, and disappears. No one sees her leave, but she is gone. Only the morning before, my mother was a housewife who, for 20 years, kept our houses swept up and sterile as the mind of winter itself. So perhaps she finally just whisk-broomed herself out. A luminous cloud of her drifting through the bedroom window is soft as talcum powder, mingling with the snowflakes as they fell, and the stardust, and the lunar ash out there. Her name is Eve, and this is Garden Heights, Ohio. So I used to like to think of my mother as Eve, the naked one, the first one, when she was in the garden, poisoning the weeds with bleach, defoliating the trees, stuffing their leaves down the garbage disposal, then scouring the sink with something chemical and harsh but powdered, something dyed ocean blue to disguise its deadly powers for the housewives like my mother who bought it, only dimly realizing that what they'd purchased with its snappy name, spick and span, Mr. Clean, fantastic, was pure acid. The blue of a child's eyes, the blue of a robin's egg, but swallow a teaspoon of that and it will turn your intestines to lace. This Eve, like the first one, was bored in Garden Heights. She spent her afternoons in the silence of a house she'd just cleaned yesterday from bottom to top, and there was nothing left for her to do beyond planning the nothing of the future, too. Sometimes, when I came home from school early, I'd find her asleep in my bed. She'd be dressed as if she had somewhere to go, black slacks, a lamb's wool sweater, pearls, dark hair set in smooth curls, folded onto her side, not a single light on in the whole house. But that afternoon, something else happened. What? I can only imagine. I imagine her standing at the bedroom window watching the sky toss its cold litter of snow on the lawn, thinking about loss or love or lust, bored again, then exploding like a bomb of feather dust or feathers or melting into the wall to wall, a milky evaporating shadow on the shag. When my father gets home from work, she is gone completely. When I get home from school, he is sitting in the living room with his suit still on, hands turned up empty on his lap. We wait all night for her to come home, but she doesn't. We don't eat dinner. We don't know how. My sheets feel frozen when I get in bed, and I can hear my father snoring in their bedroom. I realize now that I knew nothing about my mother, except that one day she was here, making dinner, cleaning the house, scowling around with that feather duster, and the next day she wasn't. But what could I have done about my mother? While she was metamorphosing right in our own home, changing, reshaping, going crazy or sane, I was becoming 16. I thought her trouble was just menopause or boredom, and by the time I might have said or done something, I was 16. My blood like a little creek flooded suddenly with hormones, a babbling brook that had become hot and high and dangerous. I fell in love with the boy next door, and my own flesh became a thing I'd never really worn before. Sometimes, pressing my palms together, I thought I felt a magnetic field between them, something invisible but shaped, like sound or heat, an egg of light, and it was as though I could hold the life force itself in my hands. Whatever my mother was up to, I didn't care. Phil, the boy next door, is tall and blonde and actively stupid. Fuckin' A, he'll say when a bit of poetry is quoted by the TV news anchor. Straight C's, he smiles, waving his report card at me in the cafeteria at school. In the summer, he wanted me to wear nothing but halter tops, and when we met in our backyards, which were separated only by a yellow ditch of daffodils, he'd come up behind me and slip his hands into the top. The fertilized lawns throbbed like green glass in the sun. Show me, I would say to Phil, as he drove us to school in his father's sedan, and he'd unzip his pants, take it out, flop it around. Phil has been my boyfriend for a year, and in that year we have talked about almost nothing. If he has any original ideas, any personal opinions wafting around like feathers in his head, he manages to keep them mostly to himself. He listens to WKLL, the heaviest of the heavy metal stations around here, but he's not the heavy metal type. He's never been to a concert and can't remember the names of the bands he likes or tell you what his favorite song is, all that car crash clutter behind the singing. He's what you'd call a clean-cut kid if you were the type of person who believed in clean-cut kids. No ripped t-shirts, no tattoos, no steel-tipped boots, as suburban as it gets. But it's always in the background as he's driving, and he nods his head as if he's listening. W-kill, the disc jockey screams between songs, sounding juvenile and half-hearted and non-violent, as if he's enjoying what he hears, as if it speaks to some part of him that is not the least bit visible to the naked eye, some slam-dancing protozoan part. I've learned to tune it out myself, having always worried that if I listened, really listen to that kind of music. It might fry some delicate tissue in my inner ear and I'd go deaf. Phil doesn't talk much, but it doesn't matter. If I'd wanted to talk, I could have talked to my mother. For a long time, she was trying to get me to talk. "Cat," she said, "do you love this boy?" "Mom," I said, turning on her, "what business of that is yours?" She was standing behind me in the bathroom, looking over my shoulder at the two of us reflected in the mirror above the sink. Just out of the shower, I had a towel wrapped around me, and a veil of steam came between us and smudged our reflections. The humidity smoothed the lines out on her face, and she looked like a foggy me. "Well, I can't stand your father," she said then, and the bluntness of it was like a rubber bat slugging into a rubber ball. "Jesus Christ," I said, "tell it to someone else," and pushed past her into the hall. As simply as my mother was here, and then she wasn't, Phil and I were virgins, and then we weren't. One afternoon when we had no school, my father was at work, my mother was still at the mall. We got into my bed, which was decorated with pansies and piled with stuffed animals that I knocked in one smooth gesture to the floor while Phil stood behind me, thumbs hooked into belt loops, waiting. Phil is lanky, and when he stands in one place, he rests all his weight on one leg, and this turns his body into nothing but angles and planes, a boy made of scrap metal. It was March, and the light that bled in under the window shades was blurred and pale, as if March had gray water in her veins. They were an attractive suburban couple. Before she vanished, you might have seen them on Wednesday night at Bob's Chop House. As the hostess led you to your table, you passed theirs, shushing past their silence, glancing at their salads. Both of them had dark hair, only faintly tipped with gray. Hers was shoulder length and smooth. His was whatever style and length was fashionable then for men. Not too long in back, not too tall on top, conservative but in touch with the times. Perhaps he was wearing the dark slacks he had worn to work that day, half a suit. He'd have left the jacket at home. My father's features were sharp, a sculpted nose and deep-set eyes. My mother's cheekbones were high, and she was slender as a girl, flat stomach, narrow hips. Her face was always made up with a careful hand, the right tint of blush, maroon lipstick, brown eyeliner, and a beige base. The girls behind those makeup counters in the department stores she frequented knew her name, her favorite shades, bisque, berry, chocolate mousse, as if you could make a woman's face into an elegant dessert eaten off a delicate plate. Good French perfume, too, eau de vie, you could smell it on her if you got close. They were well-spoken, they seemed sincere. Still, when you saw her seated across from him at Bob's Chop House, both of them sipping rocky drinks, linen napkins on their laps, shiny silverware between them, she might look up as you passed by, her blue eyes flashing, and what you'd sense, if you sensed anything at all, was cold. In truth, my mother disappeared 20 years before she did. She moved to the suburbs with a husband. She had a child. She grew a little older every day, the way a middle-aged wife and mother becomes ever more elusive to the naked eye. You look up from your magazine in the dentist's office when she walks in, but you see right through her. And the younger woman she once was, the one you might have noticed, she became no more than a ghost, a phantom girl, wandering away in a snowstorm one day. Or she became me. Maybe I stepped into the skin my mother left behind and became the girl my mother had been, the one she still wanted to be. Maybe I was wearing her youth now, like an airy scarf, an accessory, all bright nerves and sticky pearls, and maybe that's why she spent so much time staring at me with that wistful look in her eyes. I was wearing something of hers, something she wanted back. It was written all over her face. After I turned 16, I couldn't bear to look at her face as it gazed into mine. "Cat," she said, one early Saturday evening in September, standing behind me at the mirror in the hallway upstairs, "you look like I looked when I was you." I was wearing a tight black dress. Phil was taking me to homecoming. I was pinning my hair up over my neck, then letting it fall again. I'd been thinking about him, how he might pull the pins out one by one in the back seat of his father's sedan and bite my neck, unzip this black dress and slip it down over my breasts. I hated talking to my mother at all, but the worst was having to talk to her when I was thinking about sex, the sexual thought suspended, half exposed in the expression and smell of it on me. It seemed those days that my mother was always creeping up behind me just as I was leaning into an imaginary nakedness with him, as if she'd crept up after some wet trail I'd left. When there was long, moist kissing on the television, I had to leave the room. She was always looking too hard at that kiss. "What?" I asked. "I mean," she said, "you look like I looked when I was your age." And she wandered away, seeming dazed, as if time had just snuck up behind her and knocked her on the head with a very hard pillow. In December, she'd turned 46. There are a few gray strands where she parted her dark hair, and she plucked those out with tweezers at the bathroom mirror in the middle of the night when she couldn't sleep. But she was still girlishly thin, still the same weight she'd carried down the aisle beside my father 20 years before. There is a picture of them on their bedroom wall, marrying each other. In it, my father looks sheepish and stiff, but my mother already looks frantic, full of hate, wearing all that lightness, something white and exotic caught in an invisible net. That weight, or the absence of it, is draped in lace, and she drags a train of satin as long as winter or the future behind her. And there is another photograph of her that has enjoyed a fleeting fame since she disappeared, tacked to the bulletin board outside the supermarket, taped to the pharmacy's plate glass window, missing above the picture. Have you seen me? Suburban housewife, mid-40s, a whisper of frost wound through her dark hair. My father took that photograph himself, the one on the flyers, the one they used on the local 6 o'clock news. It was Christmas Day, 2 weeks before she vanished. She'd just opened a gift he'd given to her, peered at it under the tissue paper, as thin as pared skin, and said, "Don't worry, I'll take it back." "Jesus Christ, Evie, what do you want?" he asked, the camera she'd just given him dangling around his neck. "Surely not this," she said, and he snapped her bitter smile. This is a little bit about the suburb that Kat is growing up in, her mother has vanished in. My mother moved to the suburbs with a husband, and she vanished in Garden Heights. Her name was Eve, and although my father's name was Brock, not Adam, they were one of Garden Heights' first couples. Garden Heights was an Eden without a past, like the first one, but also without temptation or snakes or trees. Our house was built in the middle of a cornfield in a subdivision a few miles from Toledo, and no one had ever lived in it before us, as if God had decided to recreate the world without variety this time. Newness was the whole idea behind Garden Heights, newness and sameness. Every house in the cornfield had been built with the same blueprint, and there was even a bylaw that prohibited the building of fences and additions. The point to the place was fitting in, and my father did. This was a life he liked. Every night he came home happy. "Evie," he might say to my mother, "guess what? I bought a raffle ticket for the Board of Education benefit and won a crock pot. Look." It was brown with a long, winding cord. For years, my mother kept it above the refrigerator. Only once she let a piece of pot roast shrivel up to shoe leather in it, and after that, she threw it out. Or he'd bring home the civic section of the Monday paper, and he'd show my mother his name in it. "Brock W. Connors is to be honored by the Executive Men's Charitable Foundation for work benefiting the Lions Club of Northeastern Ohio." For weeks, he'd collected pairs of old eyeglasses, gone knock-knocking all over the neighborhood like a child's corny joke, kept them in cardboard boxes in our coat closet. When I asked him what they were for, he said they were for the poor. When I asked him what good other people's, rich people's, glasses were to the poor, he looked at me blankly, then narrowed his eyes, as if I were either very obstinate or very blurred. In Garden Heights, my father thrived like a rubber plant, left in a sunny spot and watered a lot, but my mother didn't. She was a different kind of plant entirely, a plant that could have borne thistles and juicy, dangerous fruit. Instead, she planted petunias in our yard, and by July of every year they were dried out like complaints or exasperation. Our house was stuck into some of the world's most fertile earth, black and loamy and damp, and anything could have grown there. A handful of it was as heavy as a heart or guilt. As a child, I used to dig it up with a plastic shovel and pretend to bake cakes and cookies, shapeless pastries padded out of gravity. That dough, that dirt was as dark as space. For thousands of years, our backyard had been ice, and when the ice age ended, it thawed into a swampy dinosaur forest. And when the dinosaurs got zapped by whatever zapped the dinosaurs, farmers came and turned it into farmland and country meadows, which were later bulldozed to make way for subdivisions with names like Country Meadows Estates. Still, they'd find the skeleton of a woolly mammoth in there every once in a while as they were pouring concrete for a strip mall close by, something giant and shaggy that had gotten sucked into the ancient muck. And the sweat and blood and milk of those farmers before us could still be smelled in our backyard, the smell of yeasty manure just under the golf course smell of lawn. Anything could have grown there, but my mother grew petunias. I never knew what she wanted, but I knew it wasn't in Garden Heights, and it wasn't my father. The next January, Kat's mother is still not back. Because she doesn't seem very upset or in touch with her feelings at all about her mother having just disappeared, many people suggest that she see a psychologist. And so she does. She gets a psychologist. The psychologist's name is Dr. Fahler. And like a lot of the professionals that Kat encounters kind of in her search for her mother, or to help her in her search for her mother. Dr. Fehler looks great, but isn't very good at what she does. She's not a very good shrink, although she looks good. She looks the part. So how does that feel? Dr. Fehler asks. Your mother's been gone 1 year. I shrug. Dr. Fehler is lovely today in a white wool suit. The little silver spectacles perch happily on her nose. As always, her makeup is tasteful and soft, a rose beige base, basic red lips. Right now, her eyelids are light blue, but she's done them well, not at all like Charlie's Angels, that bad 70s blue. No, the light blue on Dr. Fehler's lids make them shine like startling little pools, the kind you might glimpse from a jet over California. I want to be able to tell her how I feel about my mother being gone for 1 whole year, but what I say instead is what it seems a reasonable person in this situation would say she felt. Confused, I say, maybe mad. Dr. Fehler looks disappointed. Perhaps she was hoping I'd cry. The one time I did cry in her office, I thought I noticed a swipe of red across her neck, as if she were excited. She whipped the box of tissues out so quickly I knew she'd been waiting a long time to do it. Those tissues were pink and clammy, and they smelled like a thin layer of lotioned skin when I blew my nose in them. But I don't cry today. I don't feel sad, though I also don't feel confused or particularly mad. I've only said these things because there are no adjectives for this lightness I feel, this whiteness. It's as though I've been caught in a diaphanous net, bodiless, that net holding my whole essence loosely in a breeze. Or as though I have weights around my wrists and ankles, but the weights are lighter than I am, as though I am wearing a dress made of emotion, a damp, invisible mesh. How could I possibly tell her that? After a whole year, she asks, and I look down at my hands, which tremble a bit in my lap. It was a beautiful year, I should add. An early spring started one morning in March with a swarm of sudden, glassy bird cries, and then the cool jewelry of primrose and violet loosened themselves in the dirt. Then summer burst into the world like a gorgeous car accident, opening eyes all over our bodies in the brilliant light. Fall, the smell of pumpkin guts, sluttish and unsweetened, until winter fell all over us like pieces of heaven glazed with oxygen, hitting the ground in small, cold shards. It was like a year in Eden where no Eve had ever lived. When I was a little girl, my mother tried to curl my hair. Cat, she'd say after my bath, standing in the doorway as I toweled myself, steam obscuring us, as if we'd just stepped together into a Hollywood set of heaven. Let's do something with that hair. In that heavenly Hollywood fog, perhaps we had wings. I remember watching my own face in the mirror of her vanity as she rolled dark hanks of my hair into hot pink cushions. I was maybe 7 years old, and in that mirror, the whole future was waiting for me like a skyline of cut glass perfume bottles, silver tubes of lipstick. She wanted me as her female child to be a sylph, a girl like a powder puff, soulless, weightless, inhabiting the oxygen instead of the earth. But I was awkward and overweight, with pin straight hair, so much body on me I could never have lived in air. And those nights of pink cushioned curlers worn to bed went on forever. I dream of Hansel and his older sister Gretel in a very dark forest, dropping stones and breadcrumbs behind them, hoping. Those nights, knowing I'd wake without curls, to my mother's disappointment, I couldn't roll over in bed because the curlers, tight as they were, would yank at my scalp. In my dreams, I'd grab, panicked, for the fists of the witch who'd gotten hold of my hair before I woke, remembering who and where I was and the curlers in my head. Then in the morning, she might even seem pleased. Well, it's not curly, but it's fuller. And briefly, she'd be right. The hair stood away from my head as if it were offended. But as the day wore on, it would settle down, and my mother would gaze across the dinner table with an annoyed expression on her face. She'd look at my father and then at me again as we ate her turkey, like her silence, in thin white slices. Pass the butter, my father would say. With the butter in her hand, my father would say, please, holding it out of his reach. Please, he'd repeat, without balls, without imagination, a film of spit on his lower lip. She could barely stand to eat in his presence. I could tell by the look on her face that she wanted to throw her knife across the table and watch it vibrate in the wall. She might have been imagining the sound it would make, boing, as it wobbled there above my father's head. By the time I asked for the butter, too, she would be seething. You don't need butter, she'd say. You've got about 20 pounds of it on your hips. Evie, my father would say, looking down, counting the peas on his plate. Bless my mother, I think some days, lying on her side of the bed she shared for 20 years with my father, looking at the ceiling, trying to imagine it from her perspective. She was so wicked, such a classic case of resentment and ambivalence bumping and brushing up all against all that maternal instinct. The love and the hate in her was as vast as space, all meteors, no atmosphere. There she'd be, idling in the station wagon outside my elementary school, wearing a black turtleneck and gold hoops in her ears, beautiful and simmering. I'd come skipping out of the orange double doors with my book bag and braids, looking like a daughter you might have in an ad, happy to see you, having learned the names of the continents that day, the bloated lung of Africa, the broken arm of Europe in a cast. Now I could point those out. But looking at me, my mother would seem to have forgotten who I was, why I was bounding into her car with some atrocity of crayon and construction paper in my hand with "For Mommy" written on it. She'd seem annoyed by my drooping knee socks or a dry mustache of milk on my upper lip. As we drove home, she'd ask me about my day, but when I started to tell her about Art or Jim, she'd hush me, turn up the radio, while the announcer told her something she would rather hear, something about casualties and accidents and prisoners of war. So, this was my mother. So, we all had crappy childhoods. So, and of course, she never slapped me. We lived in a suburb without violence. My father didn't drink. He didn't even smoke. We had peace and money beyond the wildest dreams of 99% of the world, as much food as we could eat, as much Pepsi as we could drink. In the winter, we just turned the dial as high as we wanted, and there was heat. We simply pressed a handle to flush our waste away, and water as cold as we wanted or as hot. What exactly did I want? How much more plenty could I have gotten? Still, I used to lie in bed at night and imagine a huge silent bomb detonating over our house, filling the air with a clean, poisonous gas that would get in my eyes and blind me, smell like bleach, kill us in our sleep. My hair, I'd think in the morning as I passed the mirror in the hallway and caught a glimpse of my own light reflected in it, the refraction of a daughter she didn't want me to be, a daughter she had and had not wanted to have. Where is she, I think now, passing that mirror, looking for myself? Every night I pass that mirror on the way to my bedroom in the half dark of the hallway, and it looks like a cleft in the wall, a crack filled with dreams, tingling, star-infested, a door to another dimension. Where is she? I ask it, looking at me. And why did she leave? Well, the next January, Kat's mother is still not back. This is a flashback, however, to the month just before she did leave, when her behavior started becoming more and more unusual, even for her. I bought a bird, my mother told my father when she got home one Saturday from the mall. It's in the car. What? He asked, then asked again, what? I said, she said, pronouncing each word carefully, I bought a bird. Phil and I came down the stairs then. Perhaps we looked tousled, mutually pawed. At that point, my father was still naive, and he let us stay up there all day with the door closed. He must have thought we were playing an intensive game of chess, one that left us sweaty and short of breath. Go get it for me, would you? My mother said to Phil, who was used to taking orders from women. His mother issued them from her armchair all day, and that was why he spent so much time at our house, nosing through our kitchen for cheese and cold meat. And every night he stayed for dinner and liked to eat, complimenting my mother's cooking with every bite he took, mmming and nodding. She liked that and started making dishes she'd never made for my father and me, mignon alphonse, beef medallions, chicken and wine, letting the chicken stew a long time in a whole bottle of burgundy until the soaked meat shed like wet feathers from the bones, slippery, tinged with purple, and the kitchen smelled like a shelter for drunks, humid with booze, warm and debauched. Phil's mother was a terrible cook, couldn't measure, couldn't see the color or the texture of the food she made, so that even with Phil's help in the kitchen, her tuna casserole might turn out as green and soupy as a meal made of swamp, her chicken breast burnt black in a pan, and Phil ate everything my mother made as if he'd never eaten. The bird's in a cage in the back seat, my mother said to Phil. Be careful carrying it in. Phil shrugged and said, sure. He was wearing a plaid flannel shirt and jeans. His hair was bright, and little slivers of blonde shimmered on his chin and upper lip. He hadn't shaved for a day or two. What kind of bird? I asked. She said, you'll see. The bird was a canary, simple and white. It had quivered in my mother's palm at the pet store in the mall like a mouse, like a milkweed pod splitting with silk, or a feathered change purse full of blood and hollow bones. Its eyes were black beads, and they darted around the pet store while the bird sat scratching its wire feet in my mother's hand, scanning the place for cats or planning its escape, thinking, now's my big chance. But it couldn't fly away. The pet store girl had shown my mother how to hold it. Here, she said, like this, placing my mother's palm over its wings, so you can't cut off his breath. The girl was young, wearing a tight dress. Her hair was black, and she had a little clipped nose. My mother held the bird the way the pet store girl had shown her, and she could feel its heart against her lifeline, quivering like a little finger in its sleek chest. She popped it back into the cage and said to the pet store girl, "I'll take it." That canary snapped its head mechanically, like a wind-up toy, taking this new information in. "And a cage?" the girl asked. "Do you have a cage?" "No, I need a cage and food, a bird care book, all that." My mother took her credit card out of her purse, and the girl started pulling things off the shelves for her, rapeseed, millet, bath dish, perching stick. It made my mother happy. She gave the girl her credit card with a smile as she rang up the purchases, and as the bird chirped nervously near the cash register in its cage, my mother wandered into the back of the store and watched an aquarium full of small silver fish dart in and out of the ceramic mouth of a shark. She'd let the girl pick out the cage, and it was the most expensive one, the size and shape of a hat box, a high one, a hat box made for a hat with feathers and fruit and lilacs on top. "This is your guarantee that," the girl said, showing my mother a piece of paper. "The bird is a male. If it doesn't sing within 14 days, you can bring it back for an exchange. But," she said, "if you think you'll want to do that, we have to mark the bird so we know it's the same bird you bought." My mother considered it for a moment. "The guarantee, the marking." "No," she said, looking at her new bird's pure white wing. It had its head tucked under there. She didn't know how they marked birds and didn't ask. "I won't be bringing it back." The girl threw the guarantee with its gold seal away and said, "Enjoy your canary, ma'am." My mother carried the canary out of the mall like a lantern held in front of her, a hurricane lamp. Perhaps she looked like a Victorian ghost come back to haunt the mall in her wool coat, a thin and mysterious smile on her lips, headed somewhere with her bright urge in a cage. Children stumbled at the ends of their parents' arms, pointing at the bird, wanting her to stop, but she kept walking. It was only early November, but Muzak Christmas carols were piping down from the ceiling, high up near the fluorescent lights, saccharine, slippery, frivolous, sounding lubricated and far away, as if a choir of angels had been shipped to Ohio from heaven in aluminum cans, exhausted containers of angels, like poultry, chicken-feathered, passionless, disoriented. They'd been brought here against their wills, forced to spend their days warbling about God from some crawl space above the mall. With feeling, my mother imagined the maestro of corporate Christmas carols screaming, stomping his foot, waving his baton madly above them in the air. But that languid music, that spiritless serenade, oozed from the ceiling. And when she left the mall for the parking lot, my mother passed Santa near the entrance. He was smoking a cigarette. His eyes were big, as if he were medicated or insane. "Good-looking bird," he said, and wiped his nose on the back of his black glove. She'd bought a miniskirt, too, before the bird swayed, taupe. It was in a bag with the bird book and bird food slung over her other arm. She hadn't even tried it on. She'd just seen it waiting there and bought it. She pictured herself wearing it, sitting in that fat man's lap. She was happy. She hadn't had a pet since I'd grown up. After Phil brought it in, my mother set the bird up handsomely, royally, next to my father's lazy boy in the den. Its little water dish, its lettuce bowl, its perching stick. All day that canary kept its head tucked under its wing. It didn't sing, but my mother was perfectly willing to wait those 14 days. She was in no hurry to hear it sing. She had waited longer for more important things. "You like?" she asked, presenting her miniskirt to the den. It was a Sunday. My father and Phil were watching football. I was doodling into a math book with a pencil, legs tucked up under me on the couch. I'd thrown a piece of pale lettuce fringe to the canary, who pecked apathetically at it. That canary had no appetite at all. She was wearing sheer black pantyhose, black heels, a black turtleneck, and that miniskirt. "Well," she said. My father looked up from the football game like a man who'd been slapped on the ass with a towel. Phil looked sheepishly at my mother's shoes. I was stunned, looking up from her good legs to her bright face. She was flushed. Her hair was all done up, and she had a dark smear of lipstick on her lips. On the television, there was a close-up of a girl with a shredded burst of pom-pom in her fist, cheering. She must have been shaking it into the cameraman's face. "Pretty sexy for 46, don't you think?" my mother asked. I crossed my arms and looked away. My father's mouth was open. Phil was nodding yes. I'm just going to read one last section toward the very end here when Cat is starting to get more suspicious or more introspective at the same time about her mother's disappearance. Just a short section, then I thought I'd read a couple poems. I sit in the living room in one of the green-winged chairs for a long time. My father has gone to work. Outside, a plow scrapes through the streets, throwing snow to the side of the road, and the snow sounds soft, physical, a solid wave lapping at the curb, tossed out of the way. I picture a cow standing on railroad tracks, the huge machine of a train on the way, and the muffled, vulnerable sound of that cow in its path. And then I remember the sound of her voice, which was as much a part of my mother as her body, but disconnected from her, hovering around and above her, as voices do. She had a soft voice, though it was often edged with sarcasm, judgment, displeasure. I picture vowels wrapped in light, rising from her in clouds, as if something tangible could be made out of sound. I think, if the phone rang now, if I picked it up and my mother spoke to me through the receiver, would it mean she existed any more physically than she does already, living in my memory, in her silence? Have fun, she'd said, here in the living room as I left through the front door with Phil on the night of the winter formal 4 years ago. Have fun. I'd handed her the corsage box he'd brought with him when he'd come to pick me up. The rose that was in it, surrounded by its baby's breath, was pinned above my breast, and the box was empty. When my mother took it out of my hands, I could see it was lighter than she thought it would be, and cold. Phil must have kept it in his refrigerator at home. As I left for my first date, in the living room, my mother was still holding that cold emptiness in her hand. Fun was the last thing she wanted me to have. I go to the kitchen and take a carton of milk out of the refrigerator. Missing, it says on the back, and there's a grainy photo of a fat little girl right under the box where the calories are counted. On the side, there's a boy in a striped shirt. Have you seen me? He's asking with a big, lost smile on his face. I pour myself a glass of milk and take a long sip of it. The milk is cool and vaguely sour when I swallow it, gag, spit it into the sink. When I look up, my father's standing in the doorway of the kitchen. He hasn't taken his boots off. There's snow falling in soggy fractions onto the floor, and a trail of it melts behind him. For something entirely different now. This poem I guess if you don't know who Barney is, this poem's just going to be, if you don't know the incredible, heavy literary allusion of Barney, you just might as well not listen to this poem. The epigraph is, I love you, you love me. I have a 3-year-old, so I've had a lot of opportunity to watch Barney lately. And you'll probably gather in the poem. I have mixed feelings about Barney, but mostly I feel tremendous pity and affection for Barney, although that's tinged with some other things. This is Barney. I love you, you love me. He is the true zero in his cap and bells and the terrible lizard of his skin. I see him crossing the tundra in snowshoes like a big hug coming, lost on earth in a body. Consider, if I become him, what kind of suffering? This afflicted creature dancing for the hostile, costumed. Venus loves him, he loves me, has given himself to the whole world without mortification, given himself to the landscape of sap and snow and cloud, come onto the world and made it pregnant, singing to the invisible family before him, swallowing the sorrow of children, innocent, curious, extinct. A narrow stream of tears runs right through him. When the beloved is in everyone, in the excited imbecile, the timid orgy of sleep, who can help but think of Christ with his sandals and lambs? Why all of us? Why not just some? Oh, the emptiness of so much, the everlastingness, this hug, quivering, endured. A purple balloon like our hearts, naked and blown up, without flesh, wrinkles, fur. It loves without an object of it, and how we long to keep the beast of it stuffed down inside us, along with the little saints and fools who sing pitiful songs in our chests. The title of this poem is The Baby Learns to Say Baby, and the word think is in this poem about a million times, and I, of course, noticed that in editing the poem and thought, no, well, I have to leave that in there because the poem is about thinking. I think this poem is about thinking, either that or it says think about 20 times too many times in this poem. Flowering bulbs just under the snow or under a parking lot or sunk into mud where a house has been built on the mud, a foundation laid, rooms of furniture, embroidered rugs, a roof, and under it all, the small, hard bulbs of blooming that wait and want to tear it up. I think of a boy I knew who changed. He was smashed on the back of the head with a bottle one night outside a liquor store. He had been crazy, and it was the craziness I'd loved. He'd kiss my lips in public with his tongue. But then, for 7 months, he was no one. And when, again, he finally was, he was someone else. A Mormon, a worrier, a wearer of ties. He'd forgotten everything about his life except the final blow. How a bulb had exploded that first night in his brain. How it had grown hot and bright, brightness rinsing away what had accumulated there through all the years of becoming. And then the nothing, and then the waiting. The last talk we had was about the outer darkness, about God wanting to pull us out of outer darkness one by one. And also, I think of a girl I knew who was chased through a field by a man. She remembered the knife and the sky and the sound of a dog in the distance, panting hard. She ran across the fallen leaves because it was autumn, and the air was a loose dress of dampness and the warm breath of rum on her neck. She stumbled, but got up, kept running, and when she felt him touch her, when she could no longer run or pretend this wasn't what it was or bear what it was any longer, she was Laurel and untouched. And also, I saw a dog hit once by a truck. Its legs were loose as rags as the driver dragged it away. "What should I do?" I asked when I pulled over. "Nothing," he said. "There is no pain," although the eyes of the dog were open and it heard. "Who's that?" I ask and point to the baby reflected in a mirror. He pauses. Something clicks. He looks up. His tiny tongue stuck out like a scrap of velvet between his lips. Something struggles, and then he questions my reflection, thinking of the word for him, then looks at the baby again, knowing the baby for the first time. "Baby," he says, and I gasp at the image and the word reversed in my arms. I think of a crow I thought I saw one afternoon beating out of a tree, black against a blank sky, with something twice its size and also with wings and black in its beak. I think of the outer darkness again, how it hugs the world with thought, the great forgotten, remembered, wallowing, fluid and physical as a bath in which dreams and the weather and our names float in blood, and how I didn't believe in it, but that boy had carried it a long time in his brain, a thing with its own life, but part of him, swallowed like a god or a word or love or the consciousness of self. And then I carry the baby naked to his tub, pour a palmful of warm water over his head, wash it and bless it, and think of who I was. This is called, the title of this poem is "What I Hear in Your Hair" upon my son's first haircut, which I did myself and regretted a few minutes later. He had to have his hair cut, right? So, upon Jack's first haircut. Somewhere there's an office in which a secretary sits at a desk. Her task is to suppress the names of the dead. The machine she feeds makes the music of stars over traffic, the radio noise of the sky, the static of lived-up lives, placenta and ashes and air. She shreds them into thin white filaments of light, which grow longer and thinner, drift and sway in the sky like electric beach grass blown, while the mechanical teeth of her machines whir even at night, the music of mowers mowing time. It's so hard to forget, to keep them off our lips, to erase what we called them and the way they turned their plain faces toward the sound of what they thought were their names. But a few things must be left behind each hour, placenta and ashes, and there's the sound of cats lapping water from vases of daisies as we put these things away, to make room for the newly born, the infants who descend upon us newly, wanting to be called something, wanting to have a few original things to say. These babies like naked fruit with human skin expanding in our midst. Therefore, an office exists, quite simply for this, and a secretary sits at a desk doing what she does simply. Still, before I pass these scissors carefully there, I bend to kiss your head and hear their names whispered in your hair. And I'd like to end with this poem. If you have children, you probably know this already. Anything you buy for a child now these days has on it, "Do not leave baby unattended." And some of them go further and say, "No product can take the place of parental supervision." As there might be, I wonder if there are people who think they can buy a pacifier for their kid and go to Europe or something, and wouldn't have spent $1.69. But "Do not leave baby unattended" became a something I saw an awful lot of there for the first time, for the first couple years of my child's life, and pondered quite a lot. So the title of this poem is Do Not Leave Baby Unattended, Manufacturer's Warning. There is a maker who refuses to be sued, a presence among us which does not wish to be believed in or leaned on or seen. He drops a small seed in the earth, fruitful, dutiful, blind, and it is me. But the earth around it is also me. He names me this one's mother, and there will never be any other who could share a liability, if anything, if something. The unspeakable lodges itself like a boiling coin of blood on the tongue. Even if I die, this one is mine. My faith is a dove asleep in the slaughterhouse eaves. My attention is a net sewn of smoke and weight. Even if I died, my eyes would have to be always open underground or blinking in the sky. Whoever you are, up all night, embroidering warnings and disclaimers on our things, sleep easy, please. I cannot sue you. I cannot even die. Some nights are darker than trees. The sky in their hair breathes. There is no one in this house when the lights are out but the great blameless maker and the child and the mother attending these. Thank you very much.